You're listening to the Jason Greger Show podcast, brought to you by Lakewood Chev. They will steer you straight with a 39.95 wheel alignment. Check it out at lakewoodchev.com. Kevin Woodley from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com joins us. Woodley, I hope things are well as we set up for game four tonight, the Penguins and the Nashville Predators. And game three saw Pekka Rinne bounce back after some average games for him. Meanwhile, Matt Murray, probably maybe for the first time, struggling. So let's go start with Pekka Rinne. What did you see different in game three? And do you think he's back to the guy who dominated earlier in the playoffs?
To be honest with you, not really. I think it would be a little presumptuous to say that. I mean, he was, there were things that didn't change in his game from good to bad. I mean, he is always going to be overactive for his size on plays down low and in tight. Gives himself the ability to make spectacular saves. And I think of that reach back with the paddle that takes away an open net. And yet, for a goaltender his size, even on a play as dynamic as that one to the back door, you'd much rather see him actually being able to sort of quietly shift that body over or even get a pad out and, you know, not depend on, you know, basically a shooter not going shelf and just kind of getting the blade or the paddle of his stick on it. So, you know, it is always element of luck and insulation defensively that goes into this. I liked the way he recovered from a rough start. I mean, we talk about, again, a big goalie who opens up holes in tight and down low. And lo and behold, Gensel scores, you know, what, 250, 246 into the game on a rebound that goes through him. And that wasn't a good sign. But if you're the Nashville Predators or a Predators fan, you like the fact that he didn't unravel from there. That remained a part of his game, still holes that are open down low. But you combine the Preds doing a better job of not allowing a lot of those second chance opportunities. A little bit of, like I said, sort of luck using that raw skill at times, and it works. The part that still makes me nervous, and they didn't give up a lot of this, so that's part of the success, but there's still a lot of extra moving parts against rush chances. And with the Penguins' ability to go cross seam and cross ice with those types of plays and then pick spots, I think the lack of success they had in this game was probably more about not getting the same number of opportunities to take advantage of that extra movement off the rush that we see in Rinne as opposed to Rinne solving it. So no question better than the first two games. To be honest, it's hard to imagine anything worse than how Pekka played in the first two games. But a better job defensively of preventing the types of chances the Penguins were able to exploit, and that's enough. But I don't think I'd be at the point where I'd be confident saying he was, you know, back to sort of the calmer, he'll never be calm, but calmer positional play that we saw early in the playoffs.
Now, Matt Murray, very opposite, right? Fleury's probably closer to style than Rinne is, whereas Murray's a lot calmer. You know, post-game, he just said, hey, I got to play better. Was it just an off night for Murray, or did you see anything that Nashville could build on to exploit in game four tonight?
Well, no, I mean, hey, we said this going into the series. I mean, this is sort of what Matt Murray is. I mean, he's got great size. He doesn't open up holes very often, short of maybe the one under his blocker from time to time. You need to beat him by creating chances and being able to find the time and space to pick corners around the edges. Glove in particular, it's there. He struggled at times even when he makes glove saves, and we saw it even early in this series. Where he doesn't make them cleanly. There'll be second-chance opportunities in and out of his glove. But, you know, if you create those chances like they did and you start going, picking him around the edges, he's a guy who is very efficient, very effective at taking away the middle of the net. But he's, like a lot of goalies, he's exploitable around the edges. He's not going to come diving across as often as Pekka Rinne to make a spectacular save, but he's also not going to leak one through him as often. And so to me, that's all I saw in that game was Nashville creating opportunities and beating him with really good looks around the perimeter of the net. And, you know, glove side in particular, something that goes back to last season. Does he have a bad glove? I think that would be a stretch. But if you've got a choice on where to beat him, it's either under the arm on the blocker side just off the body, or it's high glove. He has made some alterations in his glove position. He's gone from early in his rookie season where he used what we would call a handshake position, where that glove's kind of almost parallel to the ice, held out his side. You'll notice now that the fingers are up, sort of almost pointing that glove straight up and presenting it nice and big to try and visually take away from the shooters what they're seeing is available high glove. Yet when they go there, it is available. He tends to move it around before, you know, early in the series, he was tracking right into it. But you saw in that game where there's some extra movement there down and up with the glove, and good shots, you know, have an opportunity to go in there. So to me, it sounds boring, but a lot of this at this stage, you know what the goalies are and what they're not. And it's your ability to either as a defense prevent the other team from getting chances to exploit it, or the types of chances that can exploit it, as an offense trying to create the chances and pick the spots that you know are available. There's not a lot of secrets at this point, and I don't expect either guy to change their game going into game four. So it'll be more about what whether the teams can kind of play systems that fit their strengths, and whether the goaltenders can kind of stay with their styles, or whether this, you know, and Pekka in particular, really start chasing the game outside of how he plays.
Kevin Woodley from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com joins us. Kevin, can you go into more depth on Murray's glove hand, and why is there potentially areas to exploit on it?
Well, listen, high glove is always high glove, right? I mean, it's an area where shooters are going to look. I can't say, you know, I don't have a save percentage on you know, exactly what the goals were for Matt Murray, high glove, you know, based on how many shots went there. So, but I mean, from a goal perspective, that's something we talked about in the playoffs last year, was there. And, you know, with him altering the position he holds it, you know, if you change your glove position, and we see a lot of this with Connor Hellebuyck in Winnipeg, he used to hold it really low, and they've tried to get him to bring it up higher. Again, Henrik Lundqvist, same thing. Roberto Luongo, 4 or 5 years ago, same thing. You get that glove held up higher because it's not so much about whether the space is there or not. It's about whether the shooters think it's there. And if they see that glove up high, especially during a regular season when the scouting report isn't as deeply adhered to or as in-depth, they might look elsewhere. And so Matt's changed the way he holds his glove to try and take away that visually. But changing where you hold it will take away a lot of the natural instincts that came over the course of his career when he held it in a different position. And listen, again, not that it's a bad glove hand, because we've seen him, especially I think it was game two, where you know there was a shot off the rush from a pretty good location where he didn't even move. It was right at his glove, and there was no drop. He stayed on his skates and just tracked it right into it, and it never moved, and a sign that he was on it and tracking. But when he starts to have to go down, and when you start to make him move before he has to make a save to the glove side, that's where that positioning is going to alter a little bit and be maybe a little bit uncomfortable. And if you look at his season, it's now 26 goals, high to mid glove versus 16 to the blocker side in the same location. So that tells you that, now, again, I don't have a save percentage because maybe there's that many more shot attempts to his glove because of this book. But at the end of the day, he gave up more goals on that side. And so you expect when they get a clean look that that's where the Nashville Predators are going to attempt to beat him.
Kevin, speaking of goaltenders, we are getting closer now to the expansion draft with Everyday, which I think as we get closer, there's a lot more intrigue to it. We've talked a lot about, you know, goaltenders that are available. And, you know, Vegas has to take three. But if I'm Vegas and I look at teams and got, when you've got Ranta and Grubauer and Korpisalo, just for argument's sake, right? We all know they're not all going to stay there because they can't all play. What do you think of the theory that Vegas loads up and maybe takes like five goalies just because they're going to trade some of them later on? Like, wouldn't that make sense when you consider, you know, how important goaltending is and how many teams really have question marks in goal?
That is something we're hearing more and more of. And, you know, I mean, I won't pretend to be the first person to say it. I can't remember where I heard it first a couple months ago that is something that's out there, that they might go as high as six goaltenders in the expansion draft. That, hey, yes, they have to take three, but they're not capped there. I heard that a couple times from goalie coaches with other organizations just in the past week, where they think, you know, they might load up and use them as assets. And you're right. Like, when you're talking about high value guys like Antti Raanta, who is a guy the Rangers would love to keep and a guy other teams would love to have because they, you know, he's an exceptional 1B option, backup option to a workhorse like Henrik Lundqvist, but I think other teams see him as maybe being capable of more, and we saw how well he played even ahead of Lundqvist for stretches this season in New York. Philip Grubauer, same thing, where, you know, a limited role behind a workhorse in Washington, other teams may covet him because they see him as having the potential to do more. And Korpisalo, who I've talked about many times, a guy who a little less experience, a little less success in the backup role, but a guy who a lot of goalie coaches around the league see as not just number one potential, but having star potential. So maybe when you've got those types of options available, you can create a bit of a seller's market and get assets in return. But I do, and that is what we're hearing more and more might be the way Vegas leans. Although at this point, you got to wonder how much, there's so much misinformation being thrown out there. You've got to be careful, because the one thing this kind of flies in the face of is goaltending's it's a devalued asset. So maybe it does change where you've got all those great names available and you can shop them if you're Vegas. But over the years, we've seen the price paid for that type of goaltending isn't particularly high. So it is a curious time. I do think that maybe the quality available may be such that you do see moves like that made. And we haven't even mentioned, obviously Fleury, a name that gets tossed around in regards to Vegas a lot. Jimmy Howard, I think, is a very intriguing option, whether it's for other teams or for Vegas, with the conundrum that the Red Wings face in terms of protecting Mrazek. And Jared Perreault, who, again, we talked to him earlier in the season, great big goaltender, struggled a little bit when he was called up with Howard out after some time in the NHL, or good start early, but then struggled a bit. But he's, you know, he just made 50-plus saves in an overtime game the other night, and he's 2-0 in the Calder Cup final on way to an American Hockey League championship. So a complicated situation for the Red Wings that could affect Vegas as well. And at the very least, I am confident in saying this. July 1st has always been a game of musical chairs for goaltenders in the NHL. And if you're not careful, you can end up without a seat. I think what we're about to see in terms of both the expansion draft and July 1st within those windows will be the greatest game of musical chairs that NHL goaltenders have ever seen. And it'll be interesting to see how Vegas plays this because, again, like you said, you can't dress all of them. And while a guy like Korpisalo holds increased value because you can put him in the American Hockey League without clearing waivers, he's one of the few among those top-end guys. So if you get four of them, and you're trying to move them, unless you do a really good job of creating a bidding war or playing that market really well, you could quite honestly end up with the number of names in free agency this summer still left, even with Bishop signing in Dallas. You could end up with teams saying, well, why am I giving you a high-value asset now? You have to put one of those guys on waivers before the season starts. So there's a little cat and mouse here. There's a little bit of chicken. And yet at the end of the day, the one thing I'm confident of, you're going to see movement like never before when it comes to goaltenders. And if you're a smart goalie evaluation team, whether you're a contender looking to prop up goaltending or maybe a team in rebuild mode looking to find a young star who's already gone through, you know, a couple of years in the American League, like a Korpisalo, and fast-track him instead of a prospect or somebody you might take in the draft, we're just going to see a ton of that movement in the next couple of weeks. It'll be fascinating to see how it all pans out.
Of those three, Korpisalo, Raanta, and Grubauer, who do you like the best and why?
Yeah, I've said it before on here. I just think the Antti Raanta has the experience. He's a great 1B. I don't know that I see him as a workhorse. And I'd love he could prove me wrong, but I don't see the same upside with him or, frankly, with Philip Grubauer as I see with Jonas Korpisalo. And I know Korpisalo has struggled at times as well. I know they won in a Calder Cup championship last season, and he lost. He wasn't the starter in the final. It was Forsberg, who struggles every time he gets called up to the NHL and is also available in this expansion draft and has been at times even better than Korpisalo in the American Hockey League. But when I look at style, when I look at skill set, when I look at the way the game is going, I think that Jonas Korpisalo has the highest upside of anybody available in the expansion draft. And that's why he was available this season, because Columbus counted on losing him. That's why you could have had him in a trade during the season, and why I think it's highly unlikely, even with some good forward or defenseman options to come out of Columbus in the expansion draft, it's unlikely that he's still there after expansion.
Quickly, what do you think Carolina does with their goaltending?
Oh, I wish I could tell you. I have a lot of confidence in Scott Darling's ability to be a number one goaltender. I wish I could tell you I had the same confidence in the Carolina Hurricanes having a clue what they're doing after acquiring him.
Yeah.
They did the same thing with Lack. They acquired a great big goaltender who had had success elsewhere. Not as much as Darling, and then tried to completely change the way he played to fit with a system that gave up more rush chances. Now, Darling's a better skater than Lack, but again, when I heard some of the buzzwords that came out of the Carolina after making the acquisition in terms of compete and athleticism and things like that, I'm just not convinced that they know what they're talking about when it comes to goaltending, that they understand that styles and systems can fit certain styles and sizes of goaltenders, that Scott Darling, who I fully believe is capable of being a number one goaltender, if you let him play the way he plays, and he is a better skater than Lack, so he will be able to play a little bit more of that dynamic style that they sort of seem to prefer. And hey, this is not just a goalie coach thing. This is also Bill Peters, who comes out of the Mike Babcock, school of head coaching. Some preferences there in terms of his goaltender being outside of the blue ice. I hope that they bring in a goalie coach. I think this is a very important hire for them, the right goalie coach, to build that bridge between Darling and the head coach to make sure that things fit style and system wise. Because I do think he has that potential, but I'm not sure what they do beyond that. I wouldn't be surprised. Normally, I'd say Eddie Lack could be bought out, but I don't see Carolina spending money just as they balked at spending money on the goalie coaching position in the past. So do they look for a trade? Probably. Are they willing to eat some of that salary versus paying it in the American Hockey League? Or, like I said, buying it out for a team that is very, not so much salary cap as budget conscious? That's possible too. And when we talk about all the musical chairs that are happening, if you're a team, especially in the Western Conference, that plays a system that doesn't give up, that, you know, even Ottawa, how little did Ottawa give up off the rush, and how much more did the Penguins struggle to score compared to what their other opponents gave up off the rush? If you have a team that takes away the neutral zone and forces team to play an end zone game, then acquiring an Eddie Lack, putting him in a situation where he can play that end zone style and a goalie coach is going to support those types of crease movements versus asking him to be a backwards flow skater, you could have a real bargain on your hands. Because a lot of people have forgotten after two bad years in Carolina, but this is a guy who put up a 917 and a 922 behind a pretty bad Vancouver Canucks team that allowed him to play to his strengths. And I think if you allow him to do that, you could have a bargain out of Carolina acquiring him.
And quickly, what's your thoughts on Allmark in Buffalo?
Another guy who I wouldn't be surprised, you know, kind of fits that mold for Vegas. Upside, I don't see it as high as Korpisalo, but he's another guy. And top of my head, I want to say that he requires waivers to go down, and that could be a part of that formula. If he doesn't, if I'm wrong saying that without my spreadsheet in front of me, Jason, and I apologize, but I closed it and I can't seem to get it open here as I'm trying to buy time. If he doesn't require waivers, then he's right up there in terms of one of those guys that pro experience, you can keep him. You can have him as your depth guy, your number three in the minor leagues next season if he doesn't require waivers. And he's a guy who might be very high on a Vegas list as somebody who could be picked. I personally don't see the upside quite as high as Korpisalo, but it's not far below it as far as if you're looking for, you know, a future really solid potential number one goaltender in the NHL, looking to have a young guy with a little bit more flexibility than, you know, just going out and get a proven veteran or a proven backup 1B like Ranta. He's another guy that I could see getting selected. Not as high as Korpisalo, but not far in that tier behind him.
Kev, as always, man, great stuff. We'll talk to you next Monday as we inch closer. We might have a Stanley Cup winner by then, and then we'll focus lots on the expansion draft and even the draft itself.
Perfect. Thanks, Jason.